Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me at the back? Any difficulty hearing at the back? No? Good. This morning's Greens List CPD breakfast briefing is on the topic of pleas and sentencing, how to improve the latter by improving the former. Very often, pleas in mitigation in criminal cases are somewhat underestimated in their importance. And we have two speakers this morning who are going to tell you a little bit about their importance and to give you some tips on how to improve your plea making. The first of our speakers is Amelia McNay, who started her life in the profession as an article clerk with Blake Dawson and then moved to Maddox as a solicitor before a stint as associate to Justice Hollingworth of the Supreme Court of Victoria. And she's been at the Victorian Bar since May of 2007 and has practiced largely in crime, doing matters in the Magistrates Court and the County Court, both for the defence and for the Office of Public Prosecutions. And she's going to speak about pleas in the Magistrates Court. To speak about pleas in the higher courts, we have Sean Cash, who comes from a long pedigree in the law, and I'm pleased to see that his father, Brian, who has done almost 50 years in the profession, is here. This morning, I asked him whether he'd come to support his boy, and he said no, he was short of CPD points. However, we're expecting some penetrating questions from him in due course. Sean started life as a solicitor with Galbally & Rolfe between 1987 and 89, came to the Victorian Bar in 1989, and spent his first 10 years at the bar doing mainly criminal trials in the County Court, back-to-back criminal trials, essentially. And as he puts it, he developed a very good plea practice, as most of them were found guilty. For the last 10 years, he's mixed his criminal practice in the higher courts with doing professional discipline work, acting for doctors and the like in the various health profession boards and before VCAT. Indeed, we've clashed more than once in that in those jurisdictions. And he's going to speak second about the art of pleas in the higher courts. Without more ado, I call upon Amelia McNay to make the first presentation. Thank you, Amelia.
Thank you, Richard. Good morning, everyone. I see that there's a mixture of some barristers from our list and also some solicitors, so hopefully this will be helpful to both of you. I'm going to be talking about pleas in the Magistrates Court, and I've got a paper that I'm going to talk to, but I've just circulated some slides that I'll be referring to throughout the talk. It goes without saying that magistrates' courts are often extremely busy, and obviously much less time will be allocated to you and your client than would be provided for in higher courts. And for that reason, your plea needs to be succinct, and you'll need to cover all your relevant points in a short space of time. Unlike the higher courts, you won't have the luxury of a fixed starting time and a decision maker who has all day or at least all morning to listen to you. Also in the magistrates' court, what's common is that matters with respect to your plea are put from the bar table as opposed to in the higher courts where often actual evidence is called. Further, the magistrate won't have read the entire police brief. They're probably only hearing about your client's matter for the first time in a summary that's been run out to them minutes before you're about to commence your plea. So for that reason, that's another reason that you need to make sure that everything is short and sharp. The first thing I've written here is something that's drilled into us in the bar readers course, and that's preparation, preparation, preparation. It sounds obvious to say read the entire police brief, but it's clearly very important because sometimes relevant statements are either missing or pending. And of course it allows you to properly advise your client about A, whether they should be pleading guilty, and B, if they do plead guilty, the likely penalty they'll receive. I'm assuming for today's purposes that you've read the brief thoroughly and discussed it with your client and advised them and you've then received instructions to enter a plea. And I think Sean in his paper will talk a bit more about negotiating and settling a plea, so getting to this point. I've also noted there that it is helpful to determine if this offending that you're dealing with in this plea breaches any suspended sentence, community-based order or intensive corrections order, because that will ultimately have an effect on the disposition that you'll be seeking. And that can be done, obviously, by checking the criminal history, which is more often than not a more accurate record of your client's recollection of their past criminal history. And then you need to liaise, obviously, with the court staff, the police prosecutor and the community corrections to have the breaches listed at the same time so your magistrate can deal with everything at once. And there's no, I suppose that's relevant because there's no point asking or pitching the plea for a community-based order in an offence that breaches a suspended sentence unless you're confident that you've got adequate material to set out exceptional circumstances. I think it's important to check the maximum penalties in relation with respect to all the offences that your client's charged with, although that's the prosecutor's duty in the higher courts at least to inform the court of the maximum penalties. I think it's important when even as a defence counsel to pitch to know what the maximum penalties are so you can pitch your plea and the ultimate disposition you'll be seeking with reference to the range of offending that you submit that your client's offending falls into. I've mentioned statistics, and I think Sean gives the website for them in his paper. They're not often used in the Magistrates Court, but there are statistics available on that website for the Magistrates Court. I don't see there's any reason why they can't be used if they assist your client. And another website that I think is useful, perhaps more so for indictable offences that are being dealt with summarily, is the Judicial College of Victoria website. That sets out everything from elements of the offence, maximum penalties, links to the statistics that I referred to, and also recent cases. And I think that can be a good starting point if you're dealing with an offence that you've never had to deal with before. The last thing I've said is know your bench. Ask around, ask other people, sit in court for a while before your plea to sense the mood of the bench, and get a feel for the sort of sentences that magistrate imposes for similar offences or similar offenders. So moving to the actual plea itself, these are relevant matters which of course you'll inform the court about, just to tell the court a bit about your client and what they've done and where they're at now. I think it's very important to get these details from a client in conference before the actual day in court. It's easy to think that this is just a plea and I'll see the client on the morning of court or I'll get counsel to meet with client half an hour before. But I think this approach fails to recognise the importance that this particular plea has for this particular client. It's useful for yourself, if you're a solicitor doing the plea yourself or for counsel's brief, to meet with the client before the day. It's difficult for counsel or you to gather all the information on the morning of the plea and think that through and put it in some sort of coherent chronological logical format. And it also, I think, can be concerning for the client if they're only meeting the person who's going to be representing them moments before they go into court. It's difficult to build a rapport and a relationship with them if you've only got that short space of time. If you don't have a lot of time, which I understand most of you probably don't, even a few basic details in a memo are helpful to give counsel a bit of an idea of the client's background. And I've set out the relevant information there. So family, what do their parents do? Are their parents together or separated? If they're separated, when did they separate and did that have any effect on the client? What's their client's past and current relationships with each parent? Do they have any siblings? What are their occupations and ages? What's your client's relationship with each of these siblings? Does your client have any other important relationships with extended family or friends? Education, Where were they educated? How far did they get, if at all, in secondary school? Have they got any tertiary education? What do they want to do in the future? Are they just starting a course? Are they hoping to start a course soon? Employment and finances, obviously finances are relevant if you're going to be pitching for a financial penalty. Set out the chronology of their employment. How long have they been in each job? Why are they out of work? Their current wages, any outstanding debts. Those factors also become relevant if you're dealing with someone who you're going to be asking the court to not impose a conviction. Those factors about future employment particularly are relevant. Relationships and children. What are the length of their significant relationships? Do they have any children? What are their ages and what's the relationship or contact that they have with them? And of course, a common theme that comes up, particularly when you're acting for clients who've got drug-related offending in the magistrates' court, is the substance abuse. Where that's relevant to the offending, set out the history. Why did they start using whatever substance they've become dependent on? When was that? Have they made any efforts at rehabilitation or undertaken any programs? For example, are they currently on methadone? If so, how much? And I suppose you can then link that back to their criminal history where it's relevant. Medical history in terms of physical and mental history is also relevant, and any other interest that they have that shows the court that they're a contributing member of the community, so sports or hobbies or anything like that. Moving on to the prior convictions, obviously the magistrate will have a copy of those because they'll be tendered by, they'll be handed up by the police prosecutor, and those consider the length or seriousness of your client's conviction. Prior convictions are obviously relevant for a magistrate when they're dealing with your client's prospects of rehabilitation and, of course, specific deterrence. Where you've got a client who's got a lot of similar offending in their past, it might be possible to explain that by reference to personal history and what's been going on in their life. You need to be able to convince the magistrate that this time is different. Why should your client be given a second or third or, in some cases, 300th chance? And so you need to think about things that are different in this plea and why this is a time of change for your client. Where there's a different type of offending, I suppose you can use that to your advantage and say, well, this is the first time he or she has offended in this way. Where there's significant gaps in a criminal history, that can be used to demonstrate that your client has good prospects of rehabilitation, that they've had trouble-free and good periods. Likewise, you could perhaps explain any bad patches by reference to personal history if there are those explanations. I think it's important to address any pending and subsequent offending and advise the court of the status of those, where they're at, what your client intends to do in relation to those. You then need to address the offences that your client comes before the court on the day. If there's a dispute as to certain facts but in the police summary but your client accepts the elements of the offence, then you can attempt to negotiate with a prosecutor or resolutions officer, I think they're sometimes called, prior to entering the plea. But once the plea's entered, it's not an opportunity to revisit the facts as per the summary because that's now been accepted. And it's not your opportunity to put your client's sort of side of the story. That said, you can provide explanations for the offending, but obviously not excuse it. The court will be interested to know when your client's plea was entered. If it wasn't at the earliest opportunity, explain why. It may be that there is a reasonable excuse. For example, you were waiting on a police statement or a drug analysis or something like that. If your client participated in a record of interview, the court, obviously, as I said, won't have a copy of that, so you can take them to it and say they made admissions, those admissions assisted the police, was your client cooperative, did they demonstrate remorse, use whatever you can from the record of interview. And again, address this offending in the context of personal history. What's the reason for this offending? Is there any valid reason? Substance use, death of a close friend or family member, relationship breakdown or loss of a job. The other factor that I'll just mention here that has become relevant for me personally, is a matter that I've been dealing with where we're questioning whether this new hate crime section of the Sentencing Act comes into play. That's section 5.2d.aaa. It's an added factor the court can have regard to. The Sentencing Act was amended, I think, either this year or last year. There's a similar amendment to the equivalent of the Sentencing Act in New South Wales. And that says that the court can have, must have regard to offending where it is wholly or partly motivated by hate or prejudice for a group or somebody associated with a particular group. The difficulty with that, I think, is that the onus is on the prosecution to prove this, like any other aggravating factor, beyond reasonable doubt. And of course, it's difficult to prove that in terms of someone's motivation, although it does apply to partial motivation. And that's just one thing that might be relevant to your client. References and psych material. References from employer or character references or long-time family friends or social workers are often tendered in the magistrate's court. I think it's important that the person writing the reference is aware of the full extent of the offending. There's no point saying, Joe Blow is a nice bloke and, you know, has helped me out on numerous occasions. I think they need to set out that they've been told why this person's coming to court today, yet they still support them and think highly of them or whatever. Again, certificates for courses of study or rehabilitation, that they're also relevant, and any courses done in custody. Drug screens are becoming more popular, I've seen in the magistrate's court. I think that gives more force and credibility to your submission that your client was, you know, using drugs or alcohol heavily at the time of the offending but is now abstinent. That's a way of sort of reinforcing that. Psychological reports, I suppose, are necessary, absolutely, if you're going to be arguing the principles in verdens, and Sean will be talking about that. I've had a couple of occasions recently where the judge hasn't been happy with the report in terms of that it hasn't adequately set out the link between the offending and the mental illness. So I suppose if you are going to get those reports and you are going to be arguing verdens, you need to ensure that you do have sufficient material there. And then finally, you'll be making a submission as to sentence. Lots of people ask for that up front, and I think it's a good idea to tell the decision maker where you're headed, to plot your plea and say, this is where I'll be going and this is why. But when you ultimately get to make the submission, again, be aware of the maximum penalties. And I only say that if you do think that the maximum penalty sounds high, it's a good idea to check the maximum penalties beforehand. I do some work for the Crown acting on appeal in the county court, and there are occasions where a magistrate has imposed a sentence that far exceeds the maximum penalty. Obviously, that's an invalid order, but it's good for you to know that at the time so you can advise your client that that's the case, and I suppose advise them of their rights of appeal. Statistics, I've put that there again. Some county court judges like them, some don't. I think they're a good starting point, but of course each case turns on its facts. One thing to remember when using them in the magistrate's court is that the statistics are often shown for a single offence, and showing the average sentence and the different dispositions that you get for one offence, when in the magistrate's court you might be dealing with multiple offences across many police briefs and aggregate sentences are common, so you need to be careful about comparing apples and oranges there. Again, think through the implications of the disposition if there are any breaches, and if you need to address exceptional circumstances, then be aware of the authorities that the Court of Appeal has set down in relation to what constitutes exceptional circumstances. Also be aware of, be prepared to make submissions if your client has offended whilst they're on bail or whilst they're on parole, or if they're a serious offender, because there are you need to look at those sections of the Sentencing Act, because there are presumptions of accumulation and so forth that apply that you need to be aware of. If you concede that jail is the only option, then consider making submissions about totality, concurrency versus accumulation, either on top of the sentence that they've currently got or across all their different, if they've got multiple offences, and the setting of a non-parole period, if that is necessary. And that's mine.